This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. Some journalists are great at breaking news. Some like digging deep into their subjects for weeks or months for investigative stories. Our guest today, Robert Carroll, has spent decades burrowing into the lives and careers of two men who he says were masters at accumulating and wielding political power. The result has been five widely acclaimed books about how things get done in the corridors of power, which have earned two Pulitzer Prizes and a host of other awards. Carroll spent 7 years writing The Power Broker about New York City insider Robert Moses and his influence on the city. And he's written 4 of 5 planned volumes on President Lyndon Johnson. At age 83, Carroll is working on the last Johnson volume about the Vietnam War, but he's also managed to write a short memoir about how he does what he does, unearthing critical facts in old and withered documents, gleaning insights from patient and persistent interviews, and writing and rewriting the stories he finds, mostly in longhand. I spoke to Carroll last week about his methods and his book called Working, Researching, Interviewing, Writing. Well, Robert Carroll, welcome back to Fresh Air. You went to Princeton, but you didn't exactly grow up in an Ivy League family. Tell us a little about your background.
Well, perhaps the most salient thing about my boyhood is that my mother died when I was 11, but got very sick when I was 5. You know, in those days, if you got breast cancer and it came back, there wasn't really very much they could do for you. So I remember that a lot. My father was, he came from Poland when he was a teenager. He spoke English. He taught himself to read and write English by copying out whole columns from the New York Times. But his language with his friends was Yiddish. So the Yiddish version of Fiddler on the Roof has been great for me.
You got sent to a good private school where you got into the school newspaper. You went to Princeton, and you became a newspaper reporter for Newsday, which did a lot of serious investigative reporting.
In those days, Newsday was a true crusading newspaper.
Right. And you did that for years.
Yes.
Why did you decide to give up daily reporting and focus on a book about Robert Moses?
Oh, you know, I was a reporter for like 6 years. I was became an investigative reporter. Then my interest was on politics, political investigations. But you never have a chance to think when you're a reporter. You're running from one story to the next. All of a sudden, I got an Eman Fellowship. That's a year at Harvard to study the area that you're covering on the paper. I was studying. I had started to get interested in Robert Moses. That's an anecdote that's going to run a little long.
Well, you know, a lot of our listeners know who Robert Moses is, but some don't. So maybe just give us a little thumbnail. Who was this guy?
Robert Moses held power in New York. He was never elected to anything. He held power in New York State and New York City for 44 years. He had more power than any mayor, more power than any governor, and more power than any mayor or governor combined. And think of it, he held it for almost half a century. And with it, he shaped New York. If you are driving on a highway or a parkway around New York City, you are driving on a road built by Robert Moses. He built 627 miles of road. He built 148,000 units of public housing. He reshaped the whole city by putting bulkheads out into the water, the ocean, Hudson River, and filling them in with shale. So he transformed the city.
And in doing that, he accumulated power. He had levers of power over people. Powerful people in Albany and in New York listened to Robert Moses.
Yes.
So you saw some of this as a reporter, and you decided you wanted to do what?
Well, I thought of doing a long series on Robert Moses. Where did he get this power? I realized I didn't know where he got it, and neither did anyone else. And it struck me, I'll never do this in the context of daily journalism. I have to write a book.
Right. And so you embarked on that project thinking it would take how long?
We had no savings, so I was trying to do it while I stayed at Newsday. I couldn't make any progress. I got a grant for a year. I said to Einar is my wife, we'll finally get to go to France. They're paying me for a year, and I'll finish this in 9 months. That's what my outline says.
And at the end of that year,
we were out of money. I had barely started the book. I knew it was going to take years and years. So we sold our house on Long Island. This was before the real estate boom, unfortunately. So we bought it for $45,000. We sold it for $70,000. So we cleared $25,000. That got us through a second year. And then we were just broke.
You got a little apartment in Spuytendyvel
in the Bronx.
In the Bronx.
Yes.
And then you'd been working on this book, and you reached out to Robert Moses, which is an enormously powerful guy.
Yes.
And they told you what?
Well, you know, over 40 years, numerous biographers, some of them quite famous, had started to do a biography on him. And I suppose he told them the same thing he told me. I was told it by two public relations men who took me out to lunch and informed me across the table that he would never talk to me, his family and friends would never talk to me. And then they had a phrase, I don't forget the exact phrase, but the import was, no one who ever wants a contract from the state or city will ever talk to you. But I started interviewing anyway. So yeah. I drew a series of concentric circles on a piece of paper. In the center, I put a dot. That dot was Robert Moses. The inner circle was his family and closest friends. The next circle was close friends, but not quite as close. I figured he could keep those people in the first couple of circles from talking to me. But out in the outer circles are all the other people that he dealt with. He couldn't think of them all. And I started interviewing them. And I don't know that this is true, Dave, since it's complimentary to me, but his closest associate, his chief subordinate, a guy named Sid Shapiro, once said to me that he realized that someone was finally going to do a biography of him, whether he wanted it or not.
Robert Moses realized.
Robert Moses, yes. And after 2 years, his daughter suddenly calls me out of nowhere. She called him Papa Bear, and she said, Papa Bear will see you. So I went to have my first interview with Robert Moses.
What was it like when you met him?
Well, it was very dramatic. He had a cottage out at Beyond Jones Beach, which is the great bathing beach that he built. It's a little community, summer community called Oak Beach. He had a summer cottage there, a very modest cottage, but he had ripped out two walls of the living room. So through the left-hand wall, you saw Robert Moses Causeway, the Robert Moses Bridge over to Fire Island.
Big bridge. Big yeah. Windows.
Oh, yeah. Big bridge. Oh, yes. There was like two whole walls of glass. So you saw this long bridge, the Robert Moses Bridge, out the left-hand window. Out the right-hand window, you saw the column of Robert Moses State Park. He sat in the corner in this huge black leather chair, Robert Moses. So when you talk to him, you're looking at Robert Moses framed by his monuments.
Wow. And was he candid?
Yes. I remember the legislature had been opposed to Jones Beach. I asked him how it was changed. He said something like the following. It was 8-7 against us in Assembly Ways and Means, but the key vote was Stevens of Cattaraugus County. And Stevens had a mortgage on his farm, and the mortgage on his farm was held by the Rochester First National Bank. And the key to the Rochester Bank was so-and-so. So we got Stevens' vote, and it was 8-7 on. He remembered all the details. Yeah.
Wow. He knew all those pressure points and remembered them. And yet, what was he like when you challenged him?
There came a point in the seventh interview where he was very... I mean, he educated me a lot, but a lot of the things that he was telling me did not comport with the facts as I was learning them from the papers of the governors that mayors that he served with. Soon as I started asking him questions, I saw his eyes change, and shortly thereafter, he said, well, that's enough for today. And I never got to see him again. Every time after that I called, the secretary said he was busy.
And when the book was published, he wrote a critique.
Oh, yes.
Long critique.
Oh, yes. You know, he was a great writer himself. He was the editor of the poetry magazine at Yale. He was a great writer. And I remember he used these phrases that, you know, he would attack me for years, you know, and you'd read this thing in the paper and you'd say, I never think of myself. It'd say, oh, that poor bastard Carol. That's me. In his first attack, I remember he was trying to make the point, a point of doubtful validity, I may tell you, that I was a Johnny-come-lately environmentalist, and that he had always been an environmentalist. And he called me a seasonal Walden Ponder. He had great phrases, yeah.
There's so many stories of how he would bend people to his will when he needed a vote from the legislature in Albany, when he needed an appropriation, when he needed a change made to the route of a road. Can you just tell us one of those stories that show how power works in ways that are unseen to the public?
Well, you know, Moses, when someone opposed him, a public official, he put what he called his team of bloodhounds, that's his investigators, onto this person. If they found anything about the person that was derogatory, he basically would say, you know, I'm going to leak it to the newspapers unless you go along. So I was examining a very mysterious thing that happened in Moses' career. He wanted to run this road, the Cross Bronx Expressway, right across the heart of the Bronx, displacing thousands of people, when there was an alternate route just two blocks away that displaced almost no one. And every elected official was against him. But all of a sudden, the key official, a lawyer for the mayor, a counsel to Mayor Wagner, changed his mind and wrote a letter saying Moses' route was good. So when I was talking to Moses, I said, what did you do to Henry Epstein? And he said something like, oh, we hit him with an axe. I said, what do you mean? And he said, I said to him, in their investigation, they had found that he had a girlfriend. He was a married man, but he had a girlfriend, a long-time girlfriend. He said, I said to Henry, you and this chum of yours. And Henry said, she's not my chum. And Moses said, oh, yes, Henry, she's your chum, all right. So Moses said to me, Bob Caro, so Henry wrote his letter.
Wow. And so that allowed Moses to take the Cross Bronx Expressway through this neighborhood of East Tremont, which displaced hundreds of thousands of people. And here's the interesting question. Why wouldn't he just take that alternate route? Why didn't he do that?
Because if he took the alternate route, he would have had to, because of a bend at the end of this mile of highway, tear down a business that was profitable to high members of the Bronx Democratic political machine.
After you finished The Power Broker, this book about this towering figure who exercised powers in many unseen ways, Robert Moses, you decided you wanted to write about Lyndon Johnson. Why? Yeah.
Well, I never was interested in writing a biography, Dave, of Robert Moses or Lyndon Johnson. I never had the slightest interest in writing a book just to tell the story of a great man. I wanted to use their lives to show how political power worked. That's what I was interested in. And with Moses, I came to see, I didn't really understand. You know, as you're doing a book, you're realizing what you're doing. You don't realize, I realized I'm writing a book about urban political power, power in cities. I said, if I ever have, remember, I was broke. My editor had told me no one was going to read this book. I said, if I ever could do another book, I'd like to do national political power, and I'd like to do it through Lyndon Johnson. Well, as it happens, I said, well, my publisher isn't going to let me do that because I signed the contract. In order to get enough money to do The Power Broker, I had to sign a two-book contract, and the second one was to do a biography of Fiorello LaGuardia, the mayor of New York. So I was starting on the LaGuardia biography. I didn't want to do it. I figured my publisher was never going to let me out. When my editor, Robert Gottlieb, he calls me up one day, and he says, now, Bob, he says, I know you're a terrible temper. We used to have terrible fights. He says, I want you to come in. I have something I want to talk to you about, and I want you to promise me you won't lose your temper until I finish. And I said, okay. And he says, I don't think you should do a biography of Fiorello LaGuardia, and I have an idea who you should do a biography of, and it should be a biography of Lyndon Johnson, and you should do it in volume so we don't have to cut any of this stuff out. I always felt I increased my advance by some substantial sum by not saying what a great idea, by saying, well, I'll think about it.
Okay. When I read the first volume of your series about Lyndon Johnson, which is Path to Power, I always tell people who are daunted by reading a book as long as you write them, trust me, you will find this fascinating from page one. And what you begin with is the history of the Hill Country, where Lyndon Johnson grew up. And I know from the book you just did that a lot of people had written biographies of Lyndon Johnson, and you thought, this will not take a lot of effort. Yeah. That ground's been covered. I'll do a few interviews and get on to the other stuff. That didn't work for you. Why?
Exactly, because when I started interviewing the people of the Hill Country where Lyndon Johnson grew up, I realized that I wasn't understanding them. This was such a lonely, remote, isolated area of the country. I was being told about a loneliness. I'm a New York boy, as you can tell from my accent, I'm sure. I couldn't grasp this loneliness. You know, his brother once said to me that a corner of the Johnson Ranch came down near what they call the Austin-Fredericksburg Road. It was just an unpaved, graded path. And he said he and Lyndon would sit on that at the fence at that corner for hours, hoping that one new rider or carriage would come by so they'd have someone new to talk to. These people were very unused to talking to strangers, and I knew they weren't giving me the true story.
Right. You moved to Austin, right? And you went and you drove out to the Hill Country to talk to these people, but that wasn't close enough.
Yes, and I had to tell my wife, you know, I don't understand this country or these people. We're going to have to move there and live there for a while. Ina said to me, why can't you do a biography of Napoleon? But we did that, and for 3 years we lived in the Hill Country.
And you learned that he wasn't an admired figure. He was a self-centered guy who a lot of people found
ruthless and fearsome, actually.
Untrustworthy, yes. Manipulative, all of that, right.
Yes.
You make the point in this book that truth takes time. If you'd relied on the other books, if you hadn't moved there, you wouldn't have gotten to that layer of depth. Lyndon Johnson is a young man in Congress, been there, I think, his second full term. And you notice that in his correspondence, he's like the new guy and doesn't expect a lot of respect from anybody else. And then there's a point where suddenly he's being treated like a man of influence.
Yes.
And you want to know why. How did you use the documents to figure this out?
Well, you're a good reader. Well, the change occurs in 1940. You can tell from the correspondence, all of a sudden people are asking for a few minutes of his time, although he's a young congressman. So I asked an old Washington fixer named Tommy the Cork Corcoran what happened. He used to call me kid. So he says, money, kid, money. But he says, you're never going to be able to write about it, kid. I said, why not? He said, because Lyndon Johnson never put anything in writing. And I, for a long time, thought that was true. And I'm going through all these boxes, you know. And all of a sudden, in the middle of a whole box of innocuous papers, there is it. He did put something in writing. He put two things in writing. There's a telegram from George Brown of Brown and Root, who were his secret but huge financial backers, saying, Lyndon, the checks are on their way, October 13th, 1940.
They owned a huge construction company.
A huge construction company, and he was getting them huge contracts from the federal government. And Lyndon says, thanks, George, I won't acknowledge this, but he had acknowledged it in writing, and the six names of the people were there, so I could cross-check into their files. And in cross-checking, in the middle of this unarranged, where people had just shoved letters in at the time, there's the most amazing document. It's about 6 pages long. It's a list. Now, two of his assistants, John Connolly and Walter Jenkins, both told me they typed the list. I don't know which one did it, but it was dramatic. In the left-hand column typed was the name of the congressman. In the center of the page was how much money he wanted. Tiny amounts by $450 for last round advertising, $600 for poll watches. They're cheating us at the polls, Lyndon. But in the left-hand margin, in Lyndon Johnson's handwriting, he had written next to every name. If he was giving the guy as much money as he asked for, this money from Texas, he wrote okay. If he was giving part of it, he wrote okay in the amount he was giving, okay 300 or okay 500. But by some of the names he wrote, none. And by some of the names he wrote, none out. And I asked John Connolly, what did none out mean? Connolly says, I can remember his tone. He was never going to get anything from Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson never forgot, and he never forgave. So Johnson is a political genius. He's gotten this money from Texas, and he's giving it out. That's the first source of his power.
Right, so we got this young congressman who gets this. He gives a bunch of federal taxpayer-funded contracts to a big contractor. They, in turn, recruit contributions from other these big wheels in Texas.
Yes.
Johnson controls that to help other members of Congress in their reelection who now owe him favors.
Exactly.
To use power to accrue power.
Exactly.
Everybody today writes on a computer. You actually do your early drafts writing longhand.
Yes.
Even though you do have a typewriter, you use a typewriter, but your first drafts are longhand.
And then the rest are on a typewriter. I don't use a computer.
Okay, but why longhand and not the typewriter from the beginning? Surely when you were a daily newspaper reporter, you typed.
Oh, sure,
you
of course.
You composed at the typewriter.
Of course. Well, it's because since you ask these very good questions that I deal with in workings, I'll tell you, it's because of something that was said to me at Princeton by an professor, a very courtly gentleman, Southern gentleman, who was my creative writing teacher. Every 2 weeks, I had a hand in a short story. I was in his course for 2 years. For 2 years, he gave me high marks. But I always did these short stories at the last minute. I mean, I remember we used to call it pulling all-nighters. I remember because I would always start at the last minute and just type because I could write very fast. At our last session, he hands back my short story with the usual, and he compliments me. And as I'm getting up to go, he says, "But you know, Mr. Caro, you will never achieve what you want to achieve unless you stop thinking with your fingers." And you know, I say in working, did you ever realize that someone has seen right through you? I realized he had seen right through me all along. He knew that I wasn't putting any thought into these. I was just writing because writing was so easy for me. So when I was a newspaper man, I was a really fast rewrite man. But when I quit to do a book and I began to realize how complex the story of Robert Moses was, I said, I must make myself think things all the way through. And the slowest way of committing your thoughts to paper is by writing in hand. So I write three or four or more. Sometimes I write a lot of drafts in hand. Then I go to my typewriter, and that's how I write.
Robert Caro, it's been fun. Thanks so much. Good luck. We'll look forward to the last volume.
Thanks for a great interview. Great questions. Thanks.
Robert Caro's books include The Power Broker about Robert Moses and four volumes of his biography of President Lyndon Johnson. He's working on the fifth, but has taken time to write a short memoir about his research and writing methods called Working. The Mekons are a British band, but to make Deserted, their first new album in 8 years, the group went to a California studio just outside Joshua Tree National Park. The band says the rugged landscape informed the highly diverse collection of songs they wrote for the album. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review of Deserted.
The Mekons are first-generation punk rockers formed in 1977 who've moved through an array of styles and genres over the decades. They've played British-style folk music, American-style country, and their own unique bashed-out variation on rock and roll. They've broken up and reassembled more than once, and nominal leader John Langford at various points was at least as much of a visual artist as anything else, painting many striking portraits of classic country stars. The band is back together with many of its key members intact, including Sally Timms, who sings the ghostly lead vocal on this track, In the Desert. Although they're a British band, the Mekons have made Chicago, the home of their record label, a base of operations at various points. But most of Deserted was written in the desert. John Langford says that the group had been writing songs in spare moments on the road during a concert tour, but the material didn't feel right. They heard about this studio outside of Joshua Tree National Park. When they arrived, they found the landscape, to quote Langford, inspirational to old pirate punk rockers. That's Lawrence of California, the band's Technicolor movie, a big rock tune that equates the 1962 Peter O'Toole desert epic Lawrence of Arabia with the harsh landscape the band found in Joshua Tree. The Mekons is an ongoing art project that's always reaching back to illustrate the present. Take, for example, their song Weimar Vending Machine. It's a gleefully elusive yet beautiful composition about a country collapsing into chaotic hostility. It's a history song that sounds right up to the minute.
Stranger in a strange land, strange to have no better plan. Iggy pops up in Berlin, her Weimar vending machine. S-A-N-D for sandwich. Out pops a pre-packed bag of sand. 10,000 grains in a Kleiner pocket. He can hide it in his hand.
The Mekons look to history again on Harar 1883. The title is a reference to the city of Harar, Ethiopia. In 1883, the French poet Arthur Rimbaud went there to escape from the European poetry world and gain some new life experiences while still in his mid-20s. The considerably older members of the Mekons tell the story with dramatic flair. Deserted is an album that, like the best of the Mekons collections, is intentionally difficult to get a fix on. It leaps around in sound and style, frequently beginning in one genre and ending in another in the space of a single song. Ultimately, it coheres as a series of arguments for the value of restlessness, for ceaseless exploration, which is just what the Mekons have been doing for more than 40 years.
Ken Tucker reviewed the new album Deserted by the Mekons. Coming up, we'll hear from actor Christopher Maloney. He's best known for playing tough guys like NYPD Detective Elliot Stabler on Law & Order SVU and inmate Chris Keller on the HBO drama Oz. He now stars in the series Happy on the Sci-Fi Channel. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who's off this week. You might not recognize the name of our guest, actor Christopher Maloney, but you'd probably recognize him from one of the 12 seasons he played as Detective Elliot Stabler on Law & Order Special Victims Unit, or his role as a sociopathic inmate in the prison drama Oz, or his work on the series Homicide. Maloney now stars in a one-of-a-kind series called Happy. It's based on a graphic novel and combines quirky characters, violent fights and chases, and wacky comedy. It airs at 10 p.m. Wednesday night on the Sci-Fi Channel, and it's now in its second season. Here's a scene from season one. Maloney's character, Nick Sachs, a disgraced cop-turned hitman, is playing a poker game with a bunch of really tough guys, and he slips into the men's room. There, he talks with a little blue flying unicorn who's actually the imaginary friend of Haley, a 10-year-old girl who's been kidnapped, who, it turns out, is Nick's daughter from an earlier relationship. Happy, the unicorn, is trying to talk Nick into rescuing Haley because he knows Nick was once a heroic cop. Nick realizes that while he can see and hear the little unicorn, nobody else can, including the guys in the card game. So he has the idea to ask Happy to fly around and look at their cards and help him cheat. Happy the Unicorn is played by Patton Oswalt, and Christopher Maloney, as the drug-addled Nick Sachs, speaks first.
Oh my goodness, I have this crazy idea. Do you want to go get Haley?
You bet I do. More than a double scoop of coffee ice cream.
You're going to help me win to get money and guns so we can go get her.
Our teacher, Miss Palm, says it's better to lose honestly than to win by cheating.
Stop me! Wouldn't Miss Palm want you to help me get guns and money so we could go get Haley?
She'd probably send us to the thinking corner to come up with a creative solution to our problems.
You're right. I just
what?
Just a crazy idea. I just thought we could be a team. You know? Partners. Butch and Sundance. Gin and Tonic. Mickey and Mallory.
You mean Mickey and Pluto?
PB and Mother J.
And that is our guest, Christopher Maloney, with the relentlessly positive unicorn played by Patton Oswalt in Happy, the series on Sci-Fi. Well, Christopher Maloney, welcome to Fresh Air. You know,
thank you.
What fun it must be to play this guy. It's like you pull out all the stops. And I always wonder when actors say, well, I read the script and I loved it, how you can look at stuff on paper and imagine what the production's going to be like, even in a more traditional dramatic film. This one, because it involves animation and just such wild mixes of action. How did you see it? How did you picture it?
Well, first of all, my biggest concern was what was on the page would not be watered down. I'd seen that before, and I was like, you know, this is one of my last rides doing, you know, extremely physical, outlandish kind of thing. And I just wanted everyone to be on the same page of if we're going to do this, let's do it right. Let's really portray what's on that page. And we did. I felt as though it was we had nothing to lose. You know, we just go full out and let the audience decide.
So in these scenes where crazy things are happening, a lot of physical violence and all kinds of arguments, part of it involves this animated unicorn floating in the air. You don't see anything? You're just imagining it? You're talking to nobody?
I actually am talking to our script supervisor, Tony, who does his own wonderful rendition of what Happy should sound like. So he helps me with the beats. But at the end of the day, what's refreshing for me and empowering, I must say, is because I don't have a true co-star, I get to kind of lead the parade. You know, I lead the scene. I guide it to where I think it needs to go because in the moment, I don't have Patton Oswalt giving me his genuine reaction to whatever I say. He has to do that later in post in the studio. So wherever I look is where the animators, you know, say to themselves, oh, okay, so maybe Happy darts back and forth here, you know, and that's because my head went left, right, left, right. So it's kind of nice for me.
So all
my co-star's never late to the set.
Well, I wanted to talk about Law & Order, which is probably the role you're, I assume, best known for. You spent, 12 seasons there. And you worked as Detective Elliot Stabler working on special victims crimes with Mariska Hargitay, she played your partner. Were you guys together the whole time you were there?
Yeah. We screen tested together. We tested for the role together. There were six actors.
So you didn't know each other beforehand, huh?
No.
And why do you think you got the parts?
Oh, boy, you know, all the actors who screen tested were great, but... And this is one of the rare moments when I walked in with Mariska. First of all, we were walking down the hall and I was telling her a joke, telling her a story that was a funny story. And we walked into the room with all the suits and, you know, all the decision makers. And I said, hold on, guys, let me just finish this story. And from that, and the chutzpah, I thought right. about it afterwards. But that was the idea of you guys will hold on because we got control of the room. We're in here and we got control of everything. We're going to control this scene and our characters. And it was pretty obvious. Even though I hadn't seen what the others had done, I walked out of that room going, wow, that was it.
Well, I wanted to play a clip here. In this scene, you are, as Detective Stabler, interrogating a child rapist who's been eluding you for years. He's played by Matthew Modine. And the scene begins with you, as Detective Stabler, leaning right into the suspect's face.
You don't need a PhD to know what kind of person you are. You're a loser. But you had a tough childhood that makes you special, that makes you a victim. You're nothing. You contribute nothing. The reason your life sucks is because you've done nothing.
I've done nothing.
You counting the little children that you've raped and murdered? Is that what you're saying to me? You want to walk me through that, you piece of garbage? Tell me how good you are at torturing children. Tell me how strong you've got to be to kill a little girl. Huh?
And that's our guest, Christopher Maloney, in Law & Order SVU, in a scene with Matthew Modine. A lot of intense stuff in this series. And you know, it's known that people that do this kind of investigative work, you know, who track predators who prey on defenseless people and commit the most awful of acts, it's psychologically damaging. It's hard to sustain. You did this for 12 years. You weren't, you know, it wasn't real. But, I don't know, did it take a toll on you? Did it affect your mood?
Yeah, first of all, let me just say, the real SVU detectives, because we toured their facilities and we got to speak with them, boy, they're really heroic, and they would tell us a few stories that you know, you can't believe it. It's there are moments of true horror out there that these civil servants try to take care of. Boy, they're the heroes. So, having said that, we took our role seriously. And I say roles even in a larger context, because it slowly dawned on us that it was more than just a procedural show, that it had larger ramifications about the messages that was being sent out. The idea of sexual abuse was more prevalent than being allowed to be gotten out there. This is happening every day, and we need to have a dialogue about it. And, you know, I just feel as though it was a very important show about touching on all aspects, whether it's gender issues, sex abuse, spousal abuse, all of these things, child abuse. You know, it became less of a job and more of a, I wouldn't say a crusade or a something larger than ourselves, I'll say that.
Right. You left the show after 12 seasons. What was it like? I mean, it just had become a part of your life for so long to not have that.
What it was like, and I knew it, I was actually very proud of myself. I always thought when I do this, I'm going to feel like the house cat that got locked out of the house. Mm. You know, so this pampered animal. You work your whole career for what I got. You know, I hit the jackpot. I hit a show that meant something, was well written, was well received. You loved the working conditions and the people. It was a well-run machine. Every aspect was there. And yet, you know, fill in the blank, the artist in me, the restless actor or creator, that guy needed to move on. But, you know, so in the interim, I just worked on other projects and I got my pilot's license. because I figured I really needed to truly focus on something that was, without question, a life or death endeavor.
This is something I didn't know. You fly airplanes.
Yeah. I got type-rated to fly a jet.
But so this was something that you kind of felt you needed to do? The thrill, the danger of it, or what?
I started SVU as a, sometimes very employed actor, but always, a journeyman type actor. And all of a sudden I had a home, and I had a lucrative home, and I had a satisfying home, and I built a family. I built a whole life. And I knew if I was walking away from all that, I needed to place that focus. Because, if you're an actor, unemployed is not a good thing. Mm. Especially when he's been employed. So, and I knew that about myself. I needed to employ myself in something that required every fiber of my being to stay focused and on top of things. And it was also good for my brain. I haven't studied that hard since college.
Well, while you were still doing Law & Order, you had this mm-hmm. role in Oz, the HBO series about prison life.
Yeah.
Where you played Chris Keller, who is, why don't you describe him? He's an inmate. Tell us about this character.
So Chris Keller was introduced season 2 of Oz to play the nemesis and lover to Lee Tergesen's Tobias Beecher. And I was there to manipulate him, and yet I fall in love with him. And I didn't ever consider my character gay. I just thought he was omnisexual. I thought he was just used sex as a weapon to manipulate people. And he has a relationship with Tobias Beecher.
And a sociopathic streak, fair to say.
Okay, so he was a serial killer. You got me, okay?
Right.
I have to tell you everything?
If we're going to quibble, yeah. Well, let's listen to a clip. Here you are. You've been in this relationship with this guy, Beecher, as you mentioned. And in this case, you have attacked him and broken his arms and legs. And you're meeting to the prison counselor, played by Rita Moreno, who wants to talk about this and about you. Let's listen.
You enjoy sex with men?
I enjoy sex, don't you? You told me you were married before you became a nun. You and your husband have great
Chris.
Sex. I mean, I can tell you did. I bet you were wild. Lint. You miss it? Sex.
I miss my husband.
Sure. You ever have sex with anyone other than him?
Chris, every time we have a session together and we get to a topic that you want to avoid, you somehow manage to turn the discussion around to me.
You noticed, huh?
I just want to get to the heart of why you did what you did to Beecher.
You saw my ex, Bonnie? When I met her, she was all alone, very unhappy. So I knew it'd be easy to get her to fall in love with me. But what I didn't know was after I broke her heart, would she still love me? See, I'm a piece of I am worthless. As bad as they come. And to have someone keep loving me, no matter how bad. You happy now? You got me to open up and spill my guts all over your table.
And that's our guest, a pretty twisted Christopher Maloney in the HBO series Oz. There's some pretty brutal violence in Oz. Were there ever members of your family that you wouldn't want to watch it?
my mother never watched. I don't think my father did. My brother and sister would get reports, and they'd be at the water cooler going, I saw your brother's beep last night.
Oh, wow.
Or I saw your brother beeping another guy last night.
You know, you were talking about how some of the plot lines that the writers came up with were really disturbing in SVU. Did you ever encounter a plot line or something in a script that you just felt you couldn't do or that you asked to be changed?
Oh, well, I asked a lot of things to be changed, but not as far as any crime was concerned. I would have a problem because they'd have us arresting someone where you're like handcuffing and arresting someone. That would actually be the biggest bugaboo for me. I'd be like, but there's no reason. We have no cause to handcuff, and it makes us look stupid. That would always be my, I'd to be the defender of my character. You know, they'd have us arresting some guy and be like, guys, you know, that's for you. You're making me look like an idiot.
You mean someone who is happy to go downtown, you don't need to cuff him and throw him in the wagon?
Yeah, except that has less impact. There's less oomph. You know, me going, sir, we're going to have to go down and talk. Commercial break, as opposed to, you, come here, grab him, slam him against the car, cuff him, we're going downtown. commercial break.
Well, Christopher Maloney, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
The pleasure was all mine. Thank you.
Christopher Maloney stars in the series Happy, which airs Wednesday nights at 10. It's now in its second season on the Sci-Fi Channel. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer this week is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.